Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, freedom for the thought we hate. My guest is two-time Pulitzer winner and longtime op-ed columnist for the New York Times, Anthony Lewis. Lewis's 50 years at the New York Times and years beforehand at other papers earned him the two Pulitzers for covering everything from the McCarthy era, civil rights, the Vietnam War, the plight of Soviet Jewry, the struggle for freedom in South Africa, and the plight of Nelson Mandela. Lewis was bombed by American warplanes while covering the Vietnam War in North Vietnam, traveled to China when virtually no one could get into that country, and around the world. His knowledge of world leaders stems from just about everyone you can think of over the last 60 years. His books include Portrait of a Decade about civil rights, Gideon's Trumpet, Make No Law about the First Amendment, and now his new book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, about core constitutional and legal issues, a specialty that Lewis grew into over his many years. In fact, he was the first full-time Supreme Court reporter ever. Now, if this sounds like a bit of a boastful and excessive introduction, in the interests of full disclosure, I have to admit, he's my father. So, goodness, Mr. Lewis, Tony, Dad, this is a first for us. Your new book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate. Let's start with, where did the title come from?
Well, it's a story. And I'll tell you the story. I was covering the Supreme Court around the year 1960, I would say. And one day, Justice Felix Frankfurter asked me to come by for a chat. It was only a chat. I never got any secrets from Supreme Court justices, but it was nice to talk to them. And that day, he was feeling irritated because some newspaper had said he was insufficiently liberal. And that naturally drove him up the wall. Especially compared with his colleagues, Hugo Black and William O. Douglas. He didn't like to be compared unfavorably to them. Suddenly he jumped up from behind his desk and said, "Liberal? I'll show you liberal." And he walked across the room to a wall of Supreme Court reports, the volumes of Supreme Court opinions. He picked one volume out, hardly looking, and opened it, handed it to me, and said, "Read." What he had given me was a dissenting opinion by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., in a case called United States against Schwimmer. Rosika Schwimmer was an immigrant to the United States from Hungary. She loved the United States, and she wanted to become a citizen, but she couldn't because she was a pacifist, and she wouldn't swear the oath that was then in use, required by law, that she promised she would take up arms to defend the Constitution. So she sued and lost, and Justice Holmes dissented. He said at the start, in a rather typically slightly sarcastic way, that he doubted that she would actually be asked to take up arms as she was a woman of a certain age. And he said he didn't agree with her about war. He knew that war was terrible, and indeed he did. This dissenting opinion of his was in 1929, and he had fought in the Civil War. Just think of the time difference. He was 89. When he wrote that dissent. And he'd been wounded three times, gravely. He knew about the horrors of war. But he said it had its noble side, and he couldn't agree with her pacifism. But he said, if there is any provision of the Constitution that more imperatively calls for attachment than any other, it is freedom of thought. Not free thought for those who agree with us, but freedom for the thought that we hate. And that's my title. But he didn't quite stop there. There's another couple of sentences which are memorable. He said, "The Quakers, pacifists, have done their part in making this country what it is. And I had not thought before now that we regretted our inability to expel them because they believe more than some of us in the Sermon on the Mount."
Tell me and the listeners about this book. It's Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment.
It's about the free expression clauses of the First Amendment. Just 14 words, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. And they are really the backbone of American democracy, because if you have a country in which, as the founders of our country, James Madison and the rest, we have a country in which the people are the ultimate rulers. They're supposed to decide, really, the great questions of policy. Then they must be informed. They have to know what's going on. They have to know what their governors, the people they have elected temporarily to govern them, are doing. That's the First Amendment, gives them that power. The central meaning of the First Amendment, to be able to criticize, know and criticize what your rulers are doing. Now, there's a tendency in all governments, in this country and elsewhere, for those who are in power to want more power. They like to act in secret because it's much less difficult to do things in secret. You can't be criticized. And they like the feeling of telling other people what to do. It's very strong under the current United States government, which is the most secret we've ever had, and has tried to accumulate more power in the president than any other executive branch. So the First Amendment is more desperately needed today than ever before.
You write about how after every great attack upon America, whether it's from communism, from sedition, from various fears over the last 100+ years, that there's always been a roll back of the First Amendment, of freedoms of one kind or another, that is followed by a coming to collective legal senses and freedoms being restored and, in fact, made even stronger.
What you say is true. In every time of fear and stress and war in American history, beginning not 100 but 200 years ago, more than 200 years ago, we've seen public opinion willing to be led, willing to give up our rights because we're afraid. And that certainly was true after 9/11. It was true in World War One. It was true in the McCarthy period, fear of communism. But after 9/11, we were so traumatized by that attack on especially the Twin Towers in New York, the heart of American commerce, that we were prepared to let the government clamp down on lots of things. The Patriot Act, the jailing of thousands of immigrants on no charge whatever, and none of them ever prosecuted for terrorism, and so on. And in that period of fear, the press just allowed the president to get away with whatever he wanted, including, most strikingly, the preparation for war and the beginning of war on Iraq, which we're still struggling with years later, a war without end. The press just seemed to have lost its guts. It was so bad that a year or two after the start of the war on Iraq, the New York Times and the Washington Post actually apologized for their indolence, their failure to carry out the great function of the press, which is to shed light on what the government is doing.
Certainly, many listeners will remember the McCarthy era, either personally or through reading about it or being educated about it. But can you go back to some of the earlier periods and remind listeners of some of the other swings of the free expression yo-yo? Pendulum, better word.
Most striking is World War One, when we ended the war in 1917, and President Woodrow Wilson, who was maybe the least civil libertarian president in American history, quite amazingly bad.
The great internationalist Woodrow Wilson.
Yes. That's why I was brought up thinking he was a great progressive internationalist. But at home, he presented to Congress an Espionage Act in 1917 and a Sedition Act in 1918 that really throttled speech. It became a crime to criticize the government's conduct of the war in the most tame ways. The case that really tells you about it, about what it was like, is a case in which, again, Justice Holmes wrote a great dissent. A group of radicals in New York had thrown leaflets from the top of a building, unsigned leaflets. Justice Holmes, in his dissent, called them puny anonymities. He didn't like them, but that didn't allow him to try to suppress them. Well, they were prosecuted for violation of the Sedition Act. What the pamphlets did was criticize President Wilson for sending American troops to Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution. It was criticism of a presidential policy, the basic kind of freedom that we have, to disagree with presidential policy. It's unthinkable that anybody could be prosecuted for disagreeing with President Bush today, as millions of Americans do. But they were prosecuted, convicted, and sentenced to 20 years in prison. 20 years in prison. And the Supreme Court upheld their conviction, and then Justice Holmes, joined by Justice Brandeis, dissented. Now that, in 1919, was the first opinion, a dissent, mind you, that treated freedom of speech as a fundamental value. 1919. And the First Amendment was added to the Constitution in 1791, so there was a long period when the courts were not enforcing that freedom. And Holmes said, "I think that we should be eternally vigilant against attempts to check the expression of opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death."
Now, those dissents obviously then became, over the last 100 years, I mean, you know, it was really the last 100 years where the First Amendment was brought through the Supreme Court and tested, but those dissents were the beginning of what we take for granted today. Can you sort of briefly describe some of the cases that came before the court, the core principles that were being tested, and what happened?
Well, the very first case in which anyone ever won a case under the First Amendment freedom of expression clauses, quite remarkably, came in 1931, 140 years after the amendment was added to the Constitution. That was a case about a woman named Yetta Stromberg who had violated a California law against carrying a red flag. Now, that shows you something about the time of fear of radicalism, made it a crime to walk down the street carrying a red flag, which was a symbol of radicalism. She was convicted, and the Supreme Court reversed that conviction, saying she had a right to express her views with what we call symbolic speech, the waving of a red flag. And the case that you'll know better, a much more recent case, is the case that held that burning a flag in a political demonstration was protected by the First Amendment. Well, that was 1931, and the same year, the court for the first time enforced the Freedom of the Press Clause. That was a case in which a newspaper in Minneapolis, Minnesota, had been shut down under a rather strange Minnesota law that allowed the suppression of malicious newspapers. And this was a very malicious newspaper, a nasty paper, run by a man called J.M. Neer. And the case is called Neer against Minnesota. And the Supreme Court held that a prior restraint, that is, squashing something before it's published, refusing to let it be published, is the worst kind of unfreedom and inherently suspect and should not be allowed.